So now I would like to introduce to you Jenny Bretnell from Independent Mental Health Advocacy. Recently, Jenny, in her old role at the Victorian Mental Illness Awareness Council, presented at the second National NDIS and Mental Health Conference in October of this year. She will again share her presentation today, that is, the NDIS and Mental Health, a Game of Snakes and Ladders, insight into the issues regarding the integration of the NDIS into the broader health system. Now, the landscape for mental health is in fluctuation, and no one at this stage knows with certainty what it will eventually look like. While service providers, the broader health system, and the NDIS continue to tussle in this time of change, the one constant in all of this are the consumers of mental health services, people with mental health conditions. Focusing on delivering services, whether that be the health system, service providers, or the NDIS, Jenny will be providing a snapshot on the current state of play or abandonment felt by consumers of mental health services. Thank you, Jenny.
Well, that was certainly a long introduction, wasn't it? Thank you very much. Just check the clicker. Beautiful. Okay. Society's understanding of mental illness has come a long way over the centuries. We now know that hearing voices doesn't mean that someone's a witch or that they're possessed by spirits. We now know that an intellectual disability is not a mental illness, nor is epilepsy. We even know that homosexuality is not a mental illness. All of these things, and many more, including vagrancy, would have resulted in a person being locked up in an asylum. Then we look at how some of the treatments have changed, from ice closets to water immersion to straight jackets and lobotomies. When I was going through this list with my mum, as you do, she said, don't forget, you know, they used to electrocute people. I had to say to her, Mum, they still do ECT. And she just was mortified. The experiences I put forward are very real experiences of people I talk with every day in my job. Mental illness is not an exact science. Psychiatry is not an exact science. People's understanding of mental illness is intrinsically linked to societal norms. In the past, all of those treatments would have been deemed to be in the best interest for people suffering from their supposed mental illness. Today, treatments and supports provided for people with mental health conditions are also delivered from a well-meaning perspective. I wonder though, in 50 years' time, will society be looking back at what we consider to be mental illness and the treatments given today with a shake of their head in disbelief and say, what were they thinking? Treatments and services can help some people, but they can also hinder. We must be open to scrutiny and self-regulation. Every single intent and notion as it relates to mental health conditions must be expendable. We all need to be open to change. Mental health conditions come in many forms and are experienced in many different ways. This will not be news to you. Just think for a moment though. Many mental health conditions arise from trauma and overwhelm. A situation or environment a person experiences that is so intolerable, the brain and body does what it has to in order for the person to survive. This is a very simplistic version of trauma and a very normal and human response to trauma. But sometimes simple is better. Trauma is indiscriminate. None of you can know with definite certainty that you will not experience such a traumatic event or circumstance in your life that your brain will do what it has to do in order to survive. Just imagine you're going about your life, getting on with business. You might be helping people with mental health conditions, providing a service or writing policies for the benefit of people. You feel good because you're contributing to a worthwhile cause. You're doing good for humanity. You have an income, family, a home, friends, and you can socialise. You may even have hobbies or things that you can do that you can pursue. There will be times when things can be monotonous, responsibilities can be heavy, families can bicker, and you're short of cash. These are problems of the Western world. By pure luck of geography, you were born or chose to come to live in Australia. If you were in Iraq, say, for instance, you'd be literally trying to stay alive amongst warring factions. Yet here you are in Australia, the lucky country, forging your way ahead, choosing how to live your life. When out of the blue, or even sneaking up on you, the big T happens. It's nothing like you've ever experienced before, and your brain and body does all it can to keep you alive. This will happen, either to you or someone that you care about. According to the Australian Bureau of Statistics, 1 in 5 Australians experience a mental health condition in a given year, and almost 1 in 2 will experience a mental health condition at some point in their life. Life, as you know it, has irrevocably changed. You can't control the way you think of things or the thoughts that invade your mind. You can't concentrate or remember even little things. You are constantly sad and anxious, and you beat yourself up over it because you can't seem to do anything. You can't function. You can't go to work and you lose your income. You can no longer afford to pay for the life that you've been living, let alone the bills, mortgage or rent you need to pay in order to keep a roof over your head. Friends start to drop off and you don't care or even notice because you just need to be alone with no additional stress or obligation, just to exist. It's hard to even form words. Everything is hard and you are constantly exhausted. After some months, maybe even years, you learn to adapt to this new way of living. You become the master of avoidance and denial. You crave your solitude and you do whatever you have to in order to feel safe. Isolation is your new best friend. People have started treating you differently, like they're scared of you, or that what you think is no longer valid. They dismiss you and all of your life experiences and knowledge. To them, you are broken and no longer useful in contributing to society. Sorry, I've skipped ahead. Yeah. In a work setting, I'm a firm believer that every person starts the day with the intention of giving it their best. This doesn't always eventuate, but the intent would have been there initially. And why is there this intent that a person has? It's because they want to believe that what they have to contribute matters. And really, when you hone down on this, it's because they intrinsically want to be valued. This is no different for a person with a mental health condition on their personal recovery journey. If this was you, this would be your deepest longing as well. Remember this when you're working with people, writing policies or designing new support programs for people with mental health condition. Think about how you would like to be treated if it was you reaching out for support, because it takes a lot of guts to ask for help. Think of the times that you've needed to ask for help with something really significant, something that you've needed desperately. From the onset of your request, there is a power imbalance. You need something and the other person has it. It's entirely up to the other person as to whether they give this thing to you, and if they do, you feel obligated to them. There is also an element of failure and worthlessness you may experience at not being able to meet your own needs. Imagine the depths that a person has reached when they have to ask for help for their own mental health, and the courage that it's taken to ask for this help. Why have I raised this? To remind each and every one of you that we are talking about people, real live human beings, not clients, consumers, patients or participants. People. People like you and me. Labels impersonalise and box people when we're also much more. Labels can trap people and confine them, stunting growth. I understand the need for labels to describe something, to categorise something, to assist in workplace systems, but it's a sad day for humanity when we forget that labels assist workplace systems and start seeing people as their labels. Keeping in mind that we all want to be valued for who we are and the guts it takes to ask for help, add to this the mix of symptoms caused by a mental health condition and the stigma attached, enter stage left, the NDIS. It's been designed to provide assistance for people with a disability to develop skills to optimise their ability, to live an ordinary life and to exercise choice and the support they receive. Fantastic. Sounds perfect. Because as human beings navigating a self-recovery journey, we know what would benefit us the most. What would help to give us the best shot at living an ordinary life? Because after all, each one of us is different. And that's where the NDIS really steps up, because it recognises this difference and wants to support our own individual goals. Finally, we'll be listened to and validated. In order to pave the way for this new way of doing things in Victoria, most of the old services and supports were removed. This in itself has been quite challenging for people with mental health conditions, because while these services were not perfect, they were something. Support was there if needed. Like a pair of comfortable worn-in slippers, people knew what to expect, which relieved some anxiety. Predictable and reliability also friends for people navigating their own personal recovery journey. Finding out that these services were no longer available was like pulling out the rug for many, leaving them off balance, out of kilter, disorientated, confused, and for some, crashing to the floor and needing hospitalisation. A lifeline was thrown out though. Services would continue through the NDIS, and the NDIA backed this up saying that no one would be worse off. Like all things shiny and new, the NDIA showed some promise. People were being transitioned over to the scheme from defined programs, and there was some excitement with personal goals being supported. Really, our spidey senses should have started tingling with the NDIA calling people participants. The Oxford Dictionary definition of participant is a person who takes part in something. So while some are taking part, some are not. And in the case of the NDIA, many are not. The best way to demonstrate the NDIS for people with psychosocial disability is to use an analogy of the game Snakes and Ladders. Why a game, you may ask? Because the NDIS has participants, rules, and you need a lot of luck. Take the cohort of people with psychosocial disability, set adrift from all that they've known, and give them a choice. Play the game or get no supports. What a great start to the NDIS mantra of choice and control. Just for the fun of it, let's put in some spinning playground equipment before the starting line and see who's left standing, albeit in a confused, anxious, distressed, traumatised and unwell manner. Just to roll the dice, a person will have to add the label disability on top of their mental health issues, identify the depth of evidence needed, come up with money to pay for appointments to get the evidence needed, wait sometimes months to get appointments with their specialists to get the evidence needed, ensure the evidence needed is written in NDIS language, focusing on what a person can't do, rely on health professionals to agree to write up reports despite a lack of information on how to do this, hope that their health professionals had the very specific expertise to write NDIS evidence. And on top of all that, revisit and refocus on all the parts of their life that cause them anguish, pain, feelings of failure, unworthiness, guilt, and feelings of helplessness. All this while living with a psychosocial disability that in itself can affect memory, thought processes, organisational ability, motivation. All this while a person is struggling to stay out of bed, can take weeks to build up the courage to make a phone call, is literally battling to stay alive. All this to get some continuity of service to support their recovery pathway that they'd previously had. Revisiting trauma is traumatising within itself. No wonder people drop off the pathway leading to the NDIS. They either end back up in hospital or hide and isolate from society to protect themselves, wanting nothing to do with the NDIS and the supports that they really need. Others have to get well enough again just to attempt the process again, and they haven't even begun to play the game. It's hard to believe that we're so cruel and inhumane. I'm not going to elaborate on each roll of the dice of this NDIS snakes and ladders game. If you've had anything to do with the NDIS, you'll know the snakes, such as $1 plans, removal of support coordination, insufficient funds, lack of psychosocial disability knowledge with both the NDIA and the local area coordinators, lack of early intervention, and the appeals and review process. There is a vicious snake I want to mention though, and it's called access denied. Two areas in particular keep popping up, being treatment and substantial functional impact. First of all, we'll look at treatment. The main reasons for denying access given by the NDIA is that not all treatment has been exhausted, including compliance with medication. If the NDIA and their lawyers don't know that one, not taking medication can be a psychosocial disability within itself, there is no overwhelming evidence to suggest that certain treatments can cure, or in the NDIS lingo remedy, psychosocial disability, that the side effects of medication can in fact create new psychosocial disabilities, that a person has a right to choose what treatment they want, then the NDIA has no right in assessing psychosocial disability applications for the NDIS. Not only are people being discriminated against, punished for having a psychosocial disability, they're also at risk of losing perhaps the only support that they have left in medical practitioners. Some medical practitioners are refusing to complete further evidence as they feel that their expertise in previous reports has been disregarded. The only loser here is the person who was meant to be helped. Then we look at substantial functional impairment. The NDIS Act 2013, Section 24, which I'm sure you all know, on disability requirement, Part 1A, states that the person has a disability that is attributable to one or more intellectual, cognitive, neurological, sensory, or physical impairments, or to one or more impairments attributable to a psychiatric condition. And further, 24.1c states, the impairment or impairments result in substantially reduced functional capacity to undertake or psychosocial functioning in undertaking one or more of the following activities. Regardless of the NDIS Act 2013 separating psychosocial disability from other disability entities with the word or, somewhere along the line, psychosocial functioning has been lumped together with functional capacity for other disabilities, to the point that the NDIA was saying that the functional impairments had to affect a person on a day-to-day basis. Now they're saying that the functional impairment is on an everyday basis. Nowhere in the NDIS Act 2013 are the words day-to-day and everyday used for access to the NDIS. Once again, this demonstrates a lack of understanding of psychosocial disability and its episodic nature, and the failure of the NDIA to utilise appropriate assessment tools. There are some ladders in this game, though, where people have had a fantastic experience. The NDIA and LACS have been wonderful and supportive, demonstrating a total understanding of psychosocial disability. There have also been attempts by the NDIA to build in more ladders with trialling new pathways. It's not all doom and gloom, but it still feels like a game as it appears to be reliant on luck. Luck in getting the right NDIA assessor, planner, and LAC. Fortunately, both the federal and Victorian state governments have recognised the gaps in the mental health systems, including the NDIS. They've witnessed and acknowledged the large sinkhole that people with psychosocial disability have been falling in. In response to this, the Victorian state government has pledged $70 million over a period of 2 years to support people with psychosocial disability and that have been deemed ineligible for the NDIS. The federal government are putting in about $6 million. This is wonderful news. A system which enables people with psychosocial disability to live an ordinary life, supports their goals and aspirations, gives them choice and control, and assists in their own personal recovery journey is needed. Any system which discriminates, devalues, and injures a person further should be stopped. The NDIS, as it relates to people with psychosocial disability, needs a major overhaul, including simple and more appropriate assessment tools, including early intervention to prevent a worsening of circumstances and disability, including identified supports like a gym membership. These are things that could really assist a person on their recovery journey. When a person who is able to work has the luxury to utilise services like the gym because they want to get fit, this is normal. It is not normal, however, for someone who has lost their income, has very limited resources, struggles with their weight and ultimately self-esteem as a direct consequence of their mental health condition, experiences anxiety and distress in being able to do things that any other person wouldn't even think twice about doing, and therefore even contemplating going to the gym is a major positive step. When something flouted as being so beneficial for psychosocial disability is out of reach, this is not normal. Any services designed to support a person on their personal recovery journey needs to enhance, not damage, needs to value the person, not disregard, needs to see that mental illness and psychosocial disability are individual to each person, not a one-size-fits-all. And how do these services identify what is really needed? By listening to the person, to what the person is saying they need, because they are the expert of their life. It may take a while for them to really verbalise what they need, but the answers are in them. Remember, the person who is reaching out for help, who knows what would work for them, could be you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jenny. That was a fantastic presentation and the same one that you presented at the last NDIS conference.
Yep.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yep.
Fantastic. Well done. Just time for questions.
Hi, that was a fantastic presentation. I have a couple of thoughts. You did a really thorough job identifying some of the core issues in terms of people with mental health issues accessing the NDIS, and this is conversations I've had with my friends who themselves struggle with mental health issues. And we were sitting around having brunch one day and talking about, Natalie, have you applied for the NDIS?
Yeah.
I have cerebral palsy, but I also have anxiety. But we kind of joked and came to the silent conclusion that it was my physical disability that would get me over the line.
It's true, unfortunately.
Yeah, and we kind of knew it. Yeah. In terms of having identified the barriers, what solutions, aside from making the clients more involved in their own treatment, are you doing on their behalf to make sure they can get that NDIS?
Yeah. In my previous role as the NDIS educator at VMIAC, I was going out and talking to them about basically what to expect. And, you know, because as far as I'm concerned, information is fantastic. So if they knew what to expect and the reality of the situation rather than the spin, that was going to help. Then we had also developed resources to help them. We've also got an advert. VMIAC also has an advocacy NDIS team, appeals and review team as well, which helps. Part of the reason that I shifted from VMIAC to my current position was purely around this, and because in this role, I'm developing it's a project to develop a peer facilitated NDIS self advocacy package for peer workers, basically. So training up peer workers to go out and you know talk to consumers and teach consumers about self advocacy in relation to the NDIS, from where to go. In that sense, and also carers, that encompasses. So that's why I'm doing that. It's pretty exciting and it's very, very much needed. We've been trying to educate practitioners. I've done a lot of education with practitioners, a lot of education with providers even, in ways to word things, what needs to be included, it seems, and I guess that a lot of you would have this experience too, that as soon as you find, okay, this is how we actually do it, the NDIA changes the ballpark, and you've got to find something that keep on adding, you know, to what's required. I actually think that there's major human rights issues that are going on, and you know, we actually need to make a stand from a human rights point of view. Because while it was fantastic, the lady earlier presenting, as some of the people were talking about it, it's like a slap in the face in the sense that providers are going to be under this scrutiny but the NDIA isn't, and it's just pretty disgusting, really.
Mm. Thank you. Some more questions? Yeah. Anyone?
Any other questions?
It doesn't have to be about the talk. It can be about psychosocial disability. Well, I was having Neil Turton Lane from VMIAC was also coming to talk about the latest sort of changes to mental health, but there'd been an incident at VMIAC, so he was unable to come at the last minute.
Hello, it's me again. I have another question, something that really stood out to me at the beginning of what you said. My parents were psychiatric nurses. They just recently retired. And you brought up the issue of electroshock treatment and how it's still being practiced. I remember the day my mother told me that as a teenager and being appalled. But when I went into my 20s, I made friends and acquaintances, a fraction of who had received ECT and received great benefits from it. And I think when people think ECT, they think of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah.
And very
I'm sure that's what my mum was thinking too.
And it's very different from that. My mother had to explain that these days they do use different strategies. They sedate the patient.
Yeah.
They're more obviously careful about how they apply it. Mm. Do you think it has a place in mental health treatment in extreme cases?
This is being live streamed.
Yeah.
I think that, yes. But I don't think that, like, because there are some people that actually want that. I don't think it should be forced on anyone at all. You know, it's the person's choice. And unfortunately still, you know, people are being forced to undertake it. In fact, the NDIA are saying that in treatments, and not all treatments have been tried, and they're actually using ECT. Well, you haven't tried ECT yet. You know, that's pretty disgusting for what's going on. And it's like I talked about earlier, people think that they're doing the right thing and they're actually meaning well in the treatments that they provide, but reason that I raised what was happening back then, what's happening now, is because I'm sure in the future people are going to look back and what we're doing now, they'll just be shaking their heads. And so that's that whole thing about not ever holding fast to this is the answer and stuff like that. But there are different treatments that will work for different people, and people will respond to that. And we need that. We need variety. But no one should be forced to actually have a treatment. It is their human right not to decide what's right for themselves at the end of the day. Yeah. Does that answer the question a bit?
Thank you. What other questions do we have? Yes.
Hi, I'm Ruth. I'm actually got a young man. I'm a parent, so I'm here as a mum. Can I just ask where autism comes into the psychosocial?
Doesn't.
It doesn't?
No.
Oh, okay. Because some people think it does.
Yeah, no, it's not being included in it at all. Okay. And autism is a really tricky one. Like, I think it's shocking what's happening within the NDIA, because for those of you that don't know, the NDIA actually re-looking at people with autism who are already participants to see whether they should stay participants. And to me, that raises a red flag for anyone else that's already a participant, and you know what they have to go through to get there, that at some stage perhaps the NDIA might, you know, give them a tap on the shoulder and say, well, you don't fit anymore. I think that's a bit of a slippery slope. Mm.
Hello there. I'm Simon Anderson from Deaf Victoria. I'm just wondering if I could ask you about our health system, the NDIA, and how they work together to support people who have mental health issues. Because I see them, I wonder whether how well they do this work together and how we can make sure that these consumers don't fall through the gaps.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's been the absolute major problem, in that consumers have been falling through the gaps. There have been people who have completed suicide. There are people who are ending back in hospital after 20-odd years who have never been, you know, back in hospital, who are ending back in hospital. Because what happened was the state government gave its money, as you would be aware, for mental health services, to all the money to the NDIA, and there were absolutely no services left for psychosocial disability. And sorry. And so what we saw happening was that as the NDIA was being rolled out in areas, people who had been under the care of service providers, they were being told, they were just being shut out, totally shut out, because they either hadn't been accepted or their applications hadn't been processed yet. So their supports were totally gone. I found it really curious that I think it was earlier on this year that the state government announced all this funding, not the one that I was just talking about, but all this funding to increase hospital beds, and you know to for more money in emergency and all that sort of stuff, because that's what was actually happening. People were getting sicker, basically. The NDIA are very, very clear in saying that things like hospitals and you know, education, all those other things, is got nothing to do with them. They have to sort of step up and man what's going on. The NDIA doesn't provide any services with that. So they actually don't work together in that sense. Another shocking fact is that that no one that I'm aware of had been accepted as with a psychosocial disability, had been accepted in as an early intervention case at all. And with the NDIA saying that early intervention with psychosocial disability purely came under the realm of medical. And you think of all the young people who may not have a diagnosis yet, and you don't need to have one to actually apply, but the likelihood of one, but they certainly have psychosocial disabilities, they're at the greatest risk of losing their family, you know, being kicked out, dropping out of school, becoming homeless, becoming further isolated. The risks for young people with psychosocial disability are massive, and that's when they need lots and lots of supports, and, you know, Headspace isn't going to cut it, unfortunately. But the NDIA won't necessarily, well, they won't take people in early intervention My way of thinking, early intervention is about prevention. Prevention from getting, things getting worse. And that's not happening. So that's another area that we need to sort of lobby and talk about.
Okay, so I have...
Sorry, just to add a brief statement to that. So our state government have recently just had our election and they've promised to have a royal commission into mental health. So I'm hoping that that will be able to have some kind of positive impact on the way that the NDIA view psychosocial disabilities.
That would be lovely. It's certainly been raised. We've been in constant communication with the mental health team for the NDIA, which is only a very small team for all of Australia. It's just really, really hard to get the message out there. They're meant to be trialling new pathways. We'll see if that actually happens, because a lot of the issues and problems that we've been coming up against are the same from 3-4 years ago, and right down to real basic ones of if someone rings you up, tell them that you want to meet in person, for a plan. Don't do it over the phone sort of thing. And we've been guaranteed that that's not happening, but it still does, So we'll see that there's, as far as the Royal Commission goes, that is fantastic that they're doing that. It depends upon the scope of the Royal Commission, and it also depends upon the role of people with lived experience of mental health within the consumers, basically, how much of a role they play. Because if you only have people like psychiatrists or doctors or service providers saying what they think, it's totally, totally disregarding the person and their experiences and what they need. And it's sort of... So we've got our fingers crossed that our consumers and carers will be absolutely included in that Royal Commission, for it to be a true Royal Commission, to really, really get to the guts of it. That's what we need.
Okay, so Melissa Hayo from Daru here. I've got two questions, really. In terms of the terminology, when does someone having a mental illness become a psychosocial disability? And the second question is, the NDIA has recently announced that they're going to do some changing or reviewing in psychosocial disability in the NDIA. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Hopefully. first of all, a mental illness is sort of like a diagnosis, and the psychosocial disability is the way that it affects a person, in their life. I give an example of two cartoon things that I've drawn, like Ben and Jerry, ice creams. But anyway, they've both been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress, anxiety, depression. One will get the NDIS, one won't. And so you look at Ben, even though he's got the diagnosis, he might be doing okay. He might be going to a course and might be doing this and might be doing that. Whereas Jerry mightn't even get out of bed. Jerry won't open his mail. He won't leave the house. So you can have the same diagnosis, but it can affect people in very, very different ways. And so the psychosocial disability is the psychological and social impacts of the mental illness. Does that explain that?
Clear as mud.
And I'm not really sure what's happening. I know that the government has extended funding, the state government has extended funding for some services to remain open for those who aren't eligible for the NDIS, which is wonderful. They are looking at trialling new pathways, and they have been trialling new pathways before. There's one that really concerns me, and I don't know enough about it yet, and be interested to see if any of you have heard about it. But I think it's in New South Wales, and it could be Hunter Valley. I might be very, very mistaken. But what they're doing is actually, you know how they've gone into partnership, I guess, with LACs, like different LACs, they've now gone into partnership on a trial basis with an organisation that's doing the functional assessment for a person, which really, really scares me, you know, that they can do that. And even though it's a trial, that evidence or that piece of that assessment can be actually used now in their eligibility. That's a big, big worry of what's going on. It's really about watching this space. There is some money out there, so let's see what they do with it. Yeah.
Okay, does anyone else have any questions?
Have you experienced dollar plans? Any of you know about dollar plans? Yeah, a couple. So when I'm talking about dollar plans, I'm talking about people who have actually been made eligible. You know, they've gone through the process. They might have come from a defined program, or they might have just got through. They get to their planning meeting and it's deemed that they don't really actually need anything, so they're given a dollar plan so that, you know, they're kept open on the books, which is pretty bad. Very, very bad. Yeah. So that's, you know, we were coming across things like that. The removal of support coordination, you would have come again, you know, that's massive. You know, there's so many, you know, the NDIA themselves are saying that they've got so many dollars left, you know, because people actually didn't utilise what was in their plans, and it's because people weren't used to the NDIS and how to navigate their way, and yet they're removing, you know, coordinators, support coordinators. It doesn't make sense. Yeah. And then the other thing that's happening within the psychosocial realm is that because it's become businesses, you know, as opposed to like community supports, a lot of them are actually closing down because it's too costly to actually provide a support for psychosocial disability. And so they're closing their doors, and a lot of people are losing their jobs. But not only that, there's not a lot out there for people if they actually do get money to tap into services. And then a lot of them are actually relying heavily on service support coordination. So when that's removed pretty much entirely and dumped with the LACs, I just think there will be less services available.